You may know the name Steve James, and you would probably associate it with a film you certainly know the name of and have seen, Hoop Dreams. You certainly know the name of Alex Kotlowitz, Chicago-based writer, and you probably first associate his name with the book There Are No Children Here, The Story of Two Boys Growing Up in the Other America. And you will know the name Kobe Williams after you hear us talk with him and see him in, quote-unquote, his movie, The Interrupters. All three of these gentlemen, along with others, have come together to make an extraordinary documentary film which will be rolling out in Chicago, New York, Los Angeles, around the country, and even in the United Kingdom and surely elsewhere soon after that. The Chicago showings will be for 2 weeks, beginning on the 12th of August at the Gene Siskel Film Center of the School of the Art Institute of Chicago, downtown at Randolph and State, and also at the Ice Theaters in Lawndale and Chatham. We'll have details up on our website. I want to first welcome all three of you gentlemen for coming into the studio today. And let's start with Alex, because in this case at least, well, the project has many roots, and the ceasefire and the violence interruption ideas have many roots. But for this project, an article that you did as a cover story in the New York Times Magazine was the first step, I guess.
You know, I've been wrestling a lot with the violence in the inner city. I mean, it was so much of my book, There Are No Children Here, was about the violence in the lives of these kids. I had stumbled across this organization, Ceasefire, here in Chicago a number of years back and got intrigued by them. It's this organization that, you know, sort of looks at violence as a public health matter. And it kind of offers this different prism to look at that issue. And it was helpful for me. It felt fresh and in the end somewhat commonsensical. But I think what really intrigued me about the organization, you know, every Wednesday there's a group of men and women, all formerly of the street, who work at Ceasefire, and their job title are violence interrupters. And what they do is they go out into the community and into the neighborhoods where they grew up, where they earned a reputation, and try to step in and mediate conflicts, try to interrupt the violence. And so I ended up spending a lot of time with them and just became real intrigued not only by their work but their own personal lives and journeys.
In a way, this was nothing's ever handed to us in these fields, but in a way, for those of us who know you personally or who know you through your work, two of your major interests are brought together here. One, what's going on in our society, particularly in our urban society and in our cities, and two, the stories of these people. And here, you almost had a weekly storytelling session.
It was. In fact, when we began filming, all we did for the first – I shouldn't say all we did, but much of what we did over those first few months was film those Wednesday meetings. I mean, in part to get to know everybody, but really more than anything to learn what was going out on the street. It was this incredible aperture onto Chicago and onto these communities.
Steve, you and Alex have known of and known each other for some time, initially through your work and then becoming friends and wanting to collaborate on something. And you just happened to read the article, though. Alex didn't say, let's make a movie or...
Well, you know, Alex and I are good friends, so I'm usually up to speed on what he's working on and vice versa. And he had told me about the ceasefire article and thought, you know, this is really exciting terrain, you know. And I think at one point you even said, like, boy, it sure would be interesting, but I don't think there's any way you could make a movie about this. And then when I read the article, I called him up and I said, I don't know about that, Alex. I think that we could possibly do this. And the big issue, you know, was could we get access to the streets to Kobe, Amina, and Eddie's mediations and be able to kind of capture some of that. And so that's why we went and met with Interrupters and with the ceasefire staff and talked about that. And we kind of came away from those initial meetings thinking, you know, we could get some mediations. And because it's not reality TV we're making, we're not looking for endless mediations. It was clear from the start that we wanted to capture some of that, but we also wanted to hopefully dig deeper into any given situation that's being mediated and understand more about what's going on with those people.
This is reality, not reality TV.
Exactly. Yeah. As a friend of mine says, reality TV is a documentary usually about something that never happened.
Right. Kobe, Amina, and Eddie refer to three of the interrupters who become the, not hosts, but both subjects and mediators for the audience in this. And that's Amina Matthews, Eddie Bocanegra, and with us in the studio right now, Kobe Williams. Kobe, what happened when these guys first showed up with you all? What tell us about your first meeting or encounter with Steve and Alex.
I think I met Steve and Alex at when I, like you were saying, our Wednesday meets. And T.O. was telling us, that's the director of Ceasefire, he was telling us they was doing a documentary on Ceasefire and the work we do in the community. So he asked us, if anything going on, call Alex or Steve so they could confirm it. So I had some situations. I just started calling Steve and Alex. But one thing I respect about Steve and Alex, they kept telling us, if we come out there and they see the cameras and all that, and they see us and they don't want to talk around us and all that, we'll understand. We'll just go about our business so we could keep doing our job, because regardless of what, we still got to work something out, mediate a conflict. So I used to tell people, man, I'm telling you, I'm coming. They call me, say we're finna go do a mediation. We're gonna work something out. I say, man, I'm letting you know up front. I got my film crew with me, so if you don't want me to bring them, let me know that. So I kept saying that and saying that. So when Steve don't go with me, it was okay.
Right. Kobe would go out there. He's such incredible rapport with people in the neighborhood, and so people just sort of, you know, took his guidance. You know, he was comfortable with us and with having us out there, and so people, I think, felt the same way.
There's a wonderful line in the film, and I do say there are lines in the film, even though obviously it's unscripted and it's a documentary, but there are wonderful talkers ranging from the people you're working with to you and your colleagues. And T.O. Hardeman, who's the founder and director of the program, is that of the ceasefire mm-hmm. part of it?
Of the Interrupters.
Of the Interrupters, excuse me, within ceasefire. Very charismatic figure. And he's got a line that I think I got correctly, and I think it sort of helps us to come into what Kobe does. And he says, ain't just no anybody can tell someone to stop shooting.
Right.
You can't just be no anybody, no. And you have a history. Maybe
right.
You should tell us a little bit about your history.
I mean,
and how you
got
came to the program.
Everybody who comes to start working with ceasefire, you got a history. Most all of us got histories. Been locked up for selling drugs or engaged in other different things, violence or all type of things. We got a background, so people know where I come from. They know what I've been through, and they know, you know, I was like them. I was part of the problem, and now, you know what I'm saying, I'm part of the solution. So people at first, when I say, man, I changed my life, I'm doing this, they're like, no, Kobe, man, you playing. You trying to trick us. You doing something else. This a front. So, but they saw me being so sincere. Anytime they call me, I'm there. They'll call me on the phone. Kobe, we got this going on. I'm always there. We'll have barbecues. We'll put up money and, you know, have an event in the community. I stayed on it, man.
How did you come to the program?
First off, when I first heard about ceasefire, I was locked up about 7 years ago, seeing little senseless baby getting killed and all that, seeing it on the news. So when I had got out, a little while after this guy introduced me to ceasefire, he introduced me to T.O. and them. And I just started doing volunteer work first and, you know, trying to get to know the program, see what it's about and all that. And I was like, man, this is the type of work I want to do. You know, I want to help these young guys in the community because I could relate to them because I grew up in a gang. I grew up without no father. I grew up my mother on drugs. So it's easy. It was just hit at home. You know what I'm saying? It was hit home. A lot of these kids just come from broken homes. I don't say they bad kids. They just ain't got no guidance. They raising themselves, so I could relate to that. What kept me on the little narrow, I was still getting in trouble all my life. I knew right from wrong. I still chose to do the wrong thing. But my grandparents was more in my life telling me I shouldn't do this, I shouldn't do that. So I stayed in contact with my grandmother and them as a kid. They started taking care of me more, and I knew I just wanted to be a part of the solution. I wanted to reach out and get back because I was part of the problem.
Was there something that changed or happened or that you thought about while you were inside? Because you did 12 years of time, three different periods as far as I know, right?
What changed me really was, too, I wanted to make that change, my son. Like, I grew up without my father. My father was in penitentiary. I was like 2 years old. I got the chance to know my father a little when I was about, I think, 11 years old. He got killed. I didn't want my son to grow up like that, you know, without his father. So I just more started concentrating more on my son. I wanted to be a man to be there for my son. Honestly, I didn't want to see no other man raising my child. Mm-hmm. I wanted to be there for him and all that. So I've thought about that more and more. I was thinking about my son. Then I kept thinking about I wanted to make a change because I tried my way. My way kept getting me in trouble, though. Kept gangbanging, just being out there doing wrong. So I wanted to make a difference. So all that tied right in. When I heard about ceasefire, I said, man, this is something right up my alley. You know what I'm saying? I want to make that change and do the right thing.
Alex, one of the many surprising and especially engaging aspects of the film, and we hear this from just what Kobe's sharing with us now, but the black family, Puerto Rican family, and so on in this country are so demonized. And one of the things that the film does, and I don't know how much it was initially a part of your all's intent as filmmakers, is show that things are much, much more complex. Not necessarily better, but much more complex. And the issues that come up about because my daddy did X or because I wanted to be with my kid, very complicated and you follow these stories in an amazing way.
Right. I don't think Steve and I had any preconceptions going into this. And I think, if anything, both of us, you know, sort of had a very open mind. But I think the one thing that was clear is that things are inevitably always more complicated than they're presented, than we understand them. And in fact, it's interesting in the movie. I mean, Kobe talks about his family and Eddie Bocanegra, I mean, he had a very solid family. I mean, his family was, you know, very close. His issues were different ones, ones of identity and sort of trying to figure out who he was and of responsibility, being the oldest child in his family and sort of knowing that he was the one who would needed to watch out for the younger ones. And so the gang was a way to do that. But absolutely. I mean, I think it's much more complicated. I mean, the other thing I think was clear to Steve and myself, and we've talked about this a lot, is, you know, you look at a journey like Kobe's and you think to yourself, my God, here's a guy who's been transformed. But I think in the end it's – and we've talked to Kobe about this, but in the end it's really sort of in some ways sort of discovering who you really are and being given that opportunity, that space.
Because where are those opportunities when you're a kid in a neighborhood like Englewood now? I mean, where are the opportunities to find out who you are without being a part of the people who say, hey, come on, be with us?
In that community, growing up like that, it's easy just to get caught up and be a part of something. Because if you feel like you ain't getting no love in the house, you don't turn to the streets where you figure you get some love from. So the streets, that's what I did. But as a kid, I knew right from wrong. But a lot of times, I choose to just do the wrong thing. My daddy was my role model. He was selling drugs, driving Cadillacs, you know, coming up and doing wrong in the game. So I really just want to be like my father. That's my role model, my father. So after my father was gone, I still want to carry that on, you know, and just be like that. But at the time, my mother owned drugs. I really, you know, had to really turn. I turned to the streets. I mean, because I want to fit in.
More important to be a part of something than whether it was something doing right or doing wrong.
Yeah. Doing wrong at the time, it felt like it was hit. That's the thing to do. And I'm around the same people just like me who ain't got no father. So it's like we come in the streets and we doing wrong together as a whole, though.
I do think that one of the keys often with situations like that Kobe found himself in, Amina and Eddie as well, is that usually the people that are able to turn their lives around in the way these guys did or find their way back to who they really wanted to be to begin with is there usually needs to be someone in their life, an adult, at a crucial moment in their life that's there for them in a very positive way. And you see that with Kobe, with his grandmother. You see that with Amina, with her grandmother. You see it with Eddie, with his family. And you see it with some of the people they work with in the film too. And I think that, you know, one of the things the Interrupters do so well is they find a way to tap into that with the people they're working with to find the people in their lives that are good role models. And if they don't have them, then they be it. You know, what mm-hmm. Kobe, Eddie, and Amina often play that role. And you see that very strongly with Amina, with Capricia in the film, that she's trying to fill a vacuum in that young girl's life.
I mean, the story of Capricia we'll come to in a little bit, but from the beginning, she grabs your attention as a viewer, and I'm sure she grabbed your all's attention as workers with her and as filmmakers, and then the depth of the tragedy inside of her just shows you how difficult it is even for the hardened interrupter, Amina. I don't want to give everything away here because there is a plot in a way, even though, again, it's a documentary. But you really care for this woman. And I think that's also a reminder of a couple of other things. One, that again, we were talking about men and kids in the street. These are men and women and boys and girls. And that's very clear how much of these things are families, blocks, interconnected families. And Steve, you've made films all around the world, even in places as exotic as Southern Illinois. but I mean, you one of the things you do, it seems, is you follow sometimes teams or groups. And there's a lot of group activity that's really – it's often somebody dissed somebody and then the group goes over there or something. That seems to be one of the things that emerges in this film.
Well, you know, you could look at this film in one way as a film in which you see these interrupters dealing with gang violence or clique violence in Chicago. And there's certainly much of that in the film, and you see that at work. I think one of the revelations, though, for us, for Alex and me in doing the film was that, you know, a lot of that we tend to assign to being gang-related or clique-related altercations, when you dig deeper into that, it's not really what's going on. So, for instance, there's a family that Kobe deals with in the early part of the film, where two young men are brothers and in warring cliques, and mom is concerned they're going to kill each other. And she has a legitimate concern there. And so, but as you go along and as Kobe works with this family and then eventually Tio gets involved, what you learn is that really the issues going on in this family are personal and part of the family. It's not about the cliques. The cliques are a manifestation of personal and family problems. And I think that that's one of the things we found throughout is that we have a tendency to want to assign it that way or view the violence as, oh, well, it's about gangs against each other, when in fact it's usually something that's much more personal. And it also explains why when you read in the paper that someone shot somebody over a pair of shoes, I think when you see this film, you begin to understand that, no, they didn't shoot somebody over a pair of shoes. The shoe altercation came at the end of a series of other things in their lives that pushed them to a brink where an argument over a pair of shoes could cause someone to become violent.
Alex?
Well, no, I was going to say there's a moment in the film when Amina talks about, you know, you're wearing your nephew's hand-me-down clothes, you know, you've had an argument with your mom, your father's off in prison, and then you go to school and somebody bumps you in the hallway and you just 30 seconds, which she talks about, these 30 seconds of rage, which really has nothing to do with the moment, which Steve just alluded to, but really has everything to do with all this other stuff going on in your life.
And that also points to why so often in these tragedies we see immediately that the person who was actually killed is almost incidental to the story. I mean, and it's always the innocent kid, it's the honor roll student, because the anger wasn't against that particular kid. Is that right, Kobe? It was against many things.
A lot of, like Steve Allen's just saying, most of a lot of stuff is, I mean, it's not game related. It's, you know, like you say, people, it'd be small altercations. He might bump me, he might look at my girl, he might hit a butt, or something real small that's leading to this. And a lot of times, like, it's like you having a bad day. So if you have a bad day, the first person bump you or look at you crazy, you don't take it out on him. That's how, for real, that's how their mindset is thinking like that, period.
It's interesting, too, because I was thinking about something else that I was following while I was also watching the film and preparing to talk to you all. And I was thinking, you know, people in certain settings, let's say affluent suburbs or other cultures, they might look at and they say, oh, my gosh, look at this. Somebody bumps into me and we work it out or whatever. But think about the times you've heard somebody say, maybe an attorney or a businessman, yeah, I was at this meeting and that guy cut me. He didn't say hello. I'm never doing business with him again. You know, I mean, so, okay, there's not a physical altercation, but it's that same thing. I was not, and I'm going to make sure my people don't, you know. So, I mean, that is something that comes out very much here is people very much want to be in their natural community, their neighbors, their families, and so on. And then if the gang comes along, it's kind of an overlay to that. You're not moving to a different neighborhood to be in the gang.
I think one of the things that's important to acknowledge is the interrupters. I mean, Kobe and Amina and Eddie. I mean, they don't dismiss people's grievances. I mean, some of the grievances are very real, and as you suggest, they're ultimately about some kind of respect. And it's really sort of that next step that they sort of are trying to sort of interrupt, so to speak, which is sort of taking that grievance and and having it become violent. But I think one of the things that's, you know, just spending time with, like Kobe, that's just incredible to watch. I mean, there's a sense of empathy. You know, man, I understand where you're coming from. I understand that. I've been there. You know, when he's on the bench with Kenneth, you talk – when you're in the car with Kenneth, you talk about your relationship with your own brother. And so – but it's sort of – so it's a sense of acknowledging this grievance that you might have. But look, here's why you shouldn't sort of take the next step.
Kobe, tell us a little bit about your co-stars. Tell us a little bit about Amina and Eddie. I understand you all get along despite the fame, the fortune, and everything.
I mean, me and Amina, first of all, we work out the same office. We was working in Englewood together. And
for those who don't know, Englewood is a neighborhood on the south side, just west of the Dan Ryan Expressway.
Sorry, yes. So me and Amina have been working out the office for, I think, a few years together. So, I mean, Amina, she real down to earth. She real straight up, and she speak up. She real straight up, and she speak her mind, though. I mean, and one thing, you know, working with Amina and Eddie, they got the passion. To do this type of work, I promise, you got to have the passion and do it from the heart. And dealing with working with Amina and Eddie, they both are sincere, and they have the passion. A lot of our other workers have the passion also, but I've been working with Amina, and I got to know Eddie a little better. You know, for I was just seeing him. We never really just hung out or kicked it or spent time together. But we grew to know each other. And it's like, man, it's so sincere, though. You know, really care. And it feel good to be working with people like Amina and Eddie who's so sincere. And I see myself in them. We see ourselves in each other because we got the same passion. Want to try to stop a shooting. We want to try to save somebody from getting hurt. So it's real. It's so sincere and real, man.
It must be the same or even more so in real life. But when you see the film and you see Eddie Bocanegra, this is an angel-faced kid. This is the gentlest person. You think, oh, my God, he's going to get killed trying to stop these people. And he's the one of you who has committed a murder.
Yes.
The rest of you guys are just small time attempt theft, you know.
Yeah, we small fries.
Yeah, you know, that's all in quotation marks.
Gang enforcer.
Gang enforcer, yeah. But here's this guy who's got something big inside there. And somehow, as different as that is, though. So you have people on the street. They're about to go at it. You just walk in?
If you're sincere about what you do and you get out there and build relationships – you got to build relationships so people could trust in you. Once I get out there, most of everybody in the community know me. I can go here. There, a lot of people know me everywhere I go. So the most important thing, once you say if I ain't know nobody, I'm just walking to something. I get out there and build relationships, open doors with them, and keep my word with them. I don't make no promise with them. I tell them I'm going to help you help yourself. We make no promise with nobody. We just get out there and do what we got to do because this is our job. So once I get out there, spend a little time with them, talk to them. Don't just talk to them when something's going on. Talk to them when nothing ain't happening. So, you know what I'm saying, you build relationships. And when something's going on, a lot of times they call me. Kobe, man, you need to get over here. This and this is going to happen. Or sometimes the people around them might call, Kobe, come over here. Woo-woo finna get into it. Don't let them know I called you. Or their parents might call. So once we build a relationship, it opened up more doors. And a lot of times, they might call you just to want to spend time with you, to ride around with you. Or they might call and say, give me $2, $3. I don't know. They might call on different things. But I'm showing that I care. I'm going to answer the phone. I ain't going to spend them or nothing. Man, I can't make it over there today. I'll see you tomorrow. A lot of times we build relationships. We take them to court when they're in trouble. We do other things with them to try to, you know, help them. But we keep our word. That's most important. We keep our word. And a lot of times in the communities I work in, and this time Stephen Allison was with me, it's times while they're just out filming me in the community and things just happen. I just go straight into it.
Being sincere doesn't cover you with kryptonite. Steve, you had two people shot in the course of making the film, right?
Yeah, I mean, two interrupters were shot during the course of the time that we were filming. They weren't shot while we were actually filming.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, the work is, you know, the work is dangerous and can be dangerous. And I think, you know, one of the things that really struck us was is that with each of them, with Eddie and with Amina and with Kobe, they each had a certain way of doing their job that was distinct to themselves and made them very effective in differing ways. You know, Kobe is like the guy you don't say no to because he's such a nice guy. He's a teddy bear. And he's so connected. You know, he's so connected in the community. We saw him hand out more business cards for Ceasefire. Now he's handing out cards on behalf of the film, which we love. You know, postcards.
And he's wearing his interrupters regalia.
Which he had made.
Okay.
Which he had made. So, you know, Kobe, that's Kobe. And it's like Kobe is the good salesman who doesn't push. He pulls. He's a guy that just pulls people into his way of thinking about things through his generosity, his good humor. Amina is someone you don't say no to, partly because you may be afraid she might actually hurt you. I'm sort of joking.
No, but there's
I'm only sort of joking.
She's physically, she's shorter.
Yes.
She's not small. She's tight. She's intense. She's follower of Sufi Islam, and so she has her head wrapped. But that, in a way, makes her face even more intense.
Yes.
And she's royalty in a way because her father was Jeff Ford.
Yeah. And so she has all of these things sort of in her arsenal, and she has this ability to sort of, you know, get in somebody's face if she feels like that's what's called for, or she can sit on a park bench and stroke Capricia's hair and try to talk to her quietly if that's what's called for. She has this unerring sense about what the situation demands. And then you have Eddie, who is the guy that for us, I think, you know, first of all, we were really taken with his personal story of, you know, a guy that's still trying to forgive himself for that murder. But I think the thing that was one of the things that was amazing to us about seeing the way Eddie works is that Eddie is always trying to think outside the box about how can I reach people. And so he finds it through art. You know, he discovered art in prison. He had a gift for it. So what does he do? He goes into a school system here. The school system doesn't like Ceasefire people coming in because of what it says, like we have a problem. So how did he get in? He got in by teaching an art class where they focused on violence as an issue. And so Eddie is one of these guys that uses that sensitivity, that artistic side to reach people. And so each of them had a totally original approach.
I have to say that Kobe was really nodding there because I think part of the unspoken point here is you have to be a little slick, too, to make this thing work, yeah. Right? You have to come off as we're all in this together. But right. you have an agenda here.
Right.
You want to stop the violence.
Right. You got to – with this type of job, you got to always be thinking on your feet. Period, man. So back in the day, my street sense, when I was doing wrong, was to do positive now and reach out to people. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can't forget where you come from and the things you've been through. I mean, it ain't nothing to praise, but you make it, switch it around, though, and do something positive with it. But you got to always be thinking on your feet. And me, honestly, and this the truth, I can't if I'm sitting down doing the mediation, whatever, I can't see nobody talking about we ain't going to work this out. We going to work this out. I'm going to find a way to get through to you, period. You can't tell me, oh, Kobe, no, go ahead on. We ain't trying to hear that. I ain't trying to hear it. I'm not trying to hear it. We going to work this out. We going to think about this. I'm going to use what I could use. I'm going to make him understand he got kids. He got mama. You got to make him understand things. When I was talking with that guy, Amo, he really wasn't getting there first, but I had to spend a lot of time. But I ain't going to say right then we have to do follow-ups. When I say you have to keep following up on people, like, man, I'm about you, man. I'm concerned about you, man. We need to work this out. So it ain't going to say it happened at one time. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it might do, but a lot of times you got to do follow-ups.
We're talking with Kobe Williams, that's C-O-B-E, Steve James, and Alex Kotlowitz. They are participants in and makers of the new film, The Interrupters, a documentary from Chicago's own Kartemquin Films, the makers of Hoop Dreams. Alex Kotlowitz, the author of a number of books, including There Are No Children Here and others. The film winds up being sort of in three acts. In the middle act, and again, it was a coincidence, but a very unhappy coincidence, a killing that captured national and international attention almost immediately because of what's known as viral videos and so on. This was the killing of Darian Albert. Alex, maybe you can set that up a bit for us and also then tell us how it was connected with the actual things going on in the film.
So, you know, Darian's killing happened early on in our filming. And as you point out, it was a young man on the south side in the Roseland neighborhood who was
– far south side of Chicago.
Far south side, who was beat to death by a two-by-four. And somebody – was caught on cell phone video and so was – shown nationally, internationally, it became huge news. The Attorney General came out, and Arnie Duncan, the head of the Department of Education, came out. There was all this outcry about the violence. And it was an important moment for us on two counts. I think one, it was a place where ceasefire, specifically Amina, became involved. Amina was sort of the guiding light for Darian's mother, who was clearly grieving and unmoored. And Amina really sort of was by her side and was by her side, as Kobe suggests, not just that day or that week, but for many, many months. But the other part of it was all this attention, as often happens in this city and elsewhere. People came from all over, journalists, politicians. And then everybody disappeared, and we were left with the violence. It didn't go away. It didn't disappear. And it was a reminder that even though we have these very public moments, these public moments of despair, of contemplation, that they come and go very quickly, and yet it still continues. And so what was important to us is sort of capturing – Kobe, Amina, and Eddie, as they went about their work in the wake of Darian Albert's.
That's generally true with these sort of – it seems like Chicago has made a specialty of these like awful, horrific, violent things that happen that capture the national attention and make the city the poster child for urban violence. But I do think that the Darian Albert murder was unique in the sense that I think it did get more the attention of people trying to wrestle with this issue. I'm not saying that they've succeeded. The school system is really trying to grapple with this, and there's been some programs that have been put in place as a result. I think that ceasefire in the wake of that, in the film you see them that they hold a peace summit for the kids at Fenger. And I think it's a really strong scene in the movie where you really begin to kind of understand what these kids are battling with each day. And they've held a number of peace summits since with kids in other neighborhoods. So I think, I do think that there's some effort being made. I don't want to dump completely on the city of Chicago on this because I think that it was such a national story and it came at such a time when it was such a crisis point in Chicago with all these public school kids being killed, that I do think it did get more attention of the people that can change it than normally happens.
Maybe what you're also saying there, Steve, maybe is that as Kobe's been underlining throughout our conversation, these things can't be fixed overnight. And maybe it got the attention in part at least of people recognizing – we have to put things in place that are going to take time. And so therefore, that's happening perhaps locally in a number of places, but it doesn't get that regular attention. I mean, Eric Holder, the Attorney General, could have moved here. It wouldn't have stopped. We had a mayor who did that once into Cabrini Green. It didn't exactly change the world. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, these things are not going to be fixed overnight, or, you know, it's going to take a while to fix. I do know that in the course of the rest of our filming, Darien Albert became a touchstone for a lot of people when they were talking about violence and when they were talking about violence in the schools in particular. Mm-hmm. And in a way, I think that's really good that it's not so quickly forgotten, at least not here in Chicago. Now, the national media, they've all moved on to the next, awful crisis.
Alex, tell us a bit about Capricia.
So Capricia is this young woman, 18 years old, who's been in and out of the foster care system, comes from a very fractured family. And when we catch up with her, we're filming a mediation that's taking place at a halfway house for people who have aged out of foster care. And so they're there until I believe they turn 21 or 22. And there's a dispute over $5. I mean, again, reasonably petty dispute that looks like it's got the potential to erupt into something more. And it's mostly boys and young men there except for Capricia. And Amina's there. And Amina quickly connects with Capricia. I mean, it's clear that from the beginning, Amina sees some of herself in Capricia, that she sees some of what she had to grapple with as a young adult. She sees Capricia grappling with that. And so Amina, to her credit, she stays with Capricia. I mean, becomes a mentor, almost a kind of surrogate mother to her. And so we follow – I don't want to give too much away, but we follow this relationship over the course of the year that we were filming. And it's got its ups and its downs.
I like to equate it to – if you've ever seen that movie Precious, which, got a lot of attention a few years ago, Capricia is – a lot like that young woman in Precious, it's fiction. But I think the difference is – one of the differences you see, because we're making a documentary and that's fiction, is that it's not so easy to turn around the kind of dysfunction you've lived with and grown up with that a girl like Capricia or Precious in the fictional vein did. And I think, if at certain points in the movie you think Amina has totally reached into the soul of Capricia and her life is now going in the right direction, and then you find out later not so fast. And I think that was really important for us to have in the movie, because it's real life, and that the best mediators, the best interrupters in our experience from doing this film are these guys that go beyond just that moment of the initial mediation, and actually they're really mediating the lives of people, not just violent situations.
Just to add to that, I think one of the things exciting about making this film was that you saw, complicated, very complicated situations like Capricia, and you also saw some real successes during the course of the film. I mean, without giving anything away, there's some surprises, things that surprised us.
Lots of surprises, frame to frame almost. I do have to ask you though, Kobe, there must be nights where you come home and it's just like, man, I need a break. I need to interrupt this interrupting business because I just lost so-and-so, or this one won't listen to me. Or, I mean, do you have that happen? And do you have other things that you do that just help shut your mind off for a while? Or?
Man, I'm getting a little better now. But I think this has really become my life. And I love what I'm doing so much. I love trying to save somebody's life. And a lot of times it starts bothering, messing up sometimes at home. You know what I'm saying? A lot of times. But it feel good, though. It feel good most of the time when you could go home saying, man, I just saved somebody's life. I just saved him from getting killed. That make me feel so good. Say if something ain't go – like, say if something I figure ain't going well, I go home and say, man, what I should have done different, what I should do. I need to work this out. So, I'm always thinking about a way to try to make it right. You know what I'm saying? Make it right. But a lot of times, I get burnt out so much times, but a lot of times I could go in real late, 2, 3 in the morning in the house and be right back up 7, 8 o'clock. trying to go back out to say, man, I got to work this out. I can't sleep on this. I got to take care of this. But a lot of times, I neglect my family sometimes at home, my wife and kids and all that. One day my son told me, I'm God, true, my wife, everybody sitting there left. He told me, we were sitting in the house, this is probably a little over a month ago, could we talk about something else besides ceasefire? And know what my wife say? Amen. She agreed with it, you know, 100%, because that's really, man, I promise, that's really have become my life. My kids right now, they don't call me Kobe, they don't call me dead, they call me ceasefire. They friends come on, what's up, ceasefire? That's how they, I mean, so I'm
it's
getting
your own
a little.
Fault.
Yeah, it's my own fault. Because I see myself saying, I'm going home to relax, or whatever you call relax. I'm out there passing out bumper stickers, right. Butts, and stickers and everything.
But you do have your family, though. I mean, Kobe's just an incredible dad to his kids. I mean, you are. So, I mean, that's you. That's your escape.
Well, you have to get them in here, I think, yeah. To ask.
Yes, we'll have to get the truth. But the fact that they can be sarcastic and well absolutely, as critical right. of you is a sign that there's yeah. a good relationship
they're,
there.
They're so proud of him.
But what really touched me, though, for real, though, my kids didn't know exactly what we do. They think we just – have barbecues and marches. For real. That's what they meant. I told Steve Allen.
The movie opened their eyes?
The movie, I'm going to be honest now, truthfully, I'm not over that. I at least watched that movie at least 100 or more. I'm just being honest and good. You hear me? But I'm saying when I watched it with my kids, though, my wife and kids in there, they was like, whoa. Like, man, this serious. Man, you be out there. They, you know, it was really touching. You
yeah.
know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And they's like, oh, no, man. They really see, you know what I'm saying, what I really do out there. You know, and it really make them think, like, man. They make, like, man, I don't know. I wouldn't be doing this type of work. That's, you know what I'm saying, how they really feel at times, though, man.
Steve, let's talk a little bit about the making of the film. Bob Elder, Robert K. Elder, wonderful Chicago journalist and writer, has a book out called, I think, The Film That Changed My Life, where he talks to various filmmakers and about the film, if there wasn't a single film. And in your case, you mentioned seeing the film Harlan County, USA, and I guess maybe in your student days.
Mm-hmm.
Or?
Yeah.
And obviously, documentarianing became a part of your blood very early on. And wondering what you brought to bear with all the experience that you've had in the decades since then that helped you get this project going, and then how you all put it together once the filming was done.
Yes. I mean, I think for me, this film, I've not had a better experience making a film than this one. And that includes Hoop Dreams, which was a great experience.
Kobe sat back.
We'll leave him alone on that one. But it's, you know, I think what was great about the experience was it was great to work with Alex. You know, we've been buddies for 10 years. So it was great to do a film with him. It was also subject matter that, you know, we both care about deeply. And for me, it was, you know, it wasn't the exact same neighborhoods that we were filming on Hoop Dreams starting back in 1987. But they were very much the same kinds of neighborhoods. We were at the West Side and in Cabrini Green there. Here we were in Englewood a lot and in Little Village and further west. So, you know, it was both sort of exhilarating to be back in that world, to be following people who you are inspired by, in the case of The Interrupters. It was also sobering to be back on the same kinds of streets and see that the same problems are there. Yes, murders are down, but there's still too many of them. See more foreclosed homes. See more people desperate to find work. So, you know, there was a lot that was sobering about this experience. But from the standpoint of the filmmaking part, I think, you know, for me, this was kind of unique because Alex was the one that suggested this. To, you know, I'm used to working very small with a crew. It's usually myself, you know, as director, and then a cinematographer and a sound person. We usually don't go any bigger than three, and sometimes I would do sound to keep us even smaller. And when Alex and I were thinking about this project together, and Alex wanted to suggest, he said, what do you think about you actually shooting this? And I was saying, well, have you ever seen any of my shooting before? But you know, it actually was a good idea because it allowed us to still remain small, which was really important to us. And so then we could be as intimate and small in our approach, because I think the key to this kind of filmmaking where you're following people's lives, which is, you know, a lot of what I've done and it's what Alex has done in his books, is you want to achieve a level of intimacy with your subjects and a level of trust that allows you into those moments that most people don't expect to be privy to when they watch a movie, to watch a documentary.
Alex, one of the wonderful things about your career is that you've worked on these themes and subjects in just about every medium, maybe not stand-up comedy, but alternative newspapers, daily national newspapers, local papers, magazines, books. You wrote a play that was produced by Pegasus Players here in Chicago, radio and television, where you've won national awards for both with public programming on both, and now a documentary film. What was the same and what was different for you about doing a film?
Well, I think, first of all, I'll echo what Steve said. I don't think I've ever had so much fun working on a project. I mean, a large part, again, working with Steve was just an incredible joy. And then Kobe and Mina and Eddie, I mean, you couldn't have asked for better subjects. I mean, not only are they inspiring people, but they were just, as you can tell, just a hell of a lot of fun to hang around. But, you know, I had concerns going in, and one of which was, is, you know, I love documentary film, and having done some on television myself, nothing this ambitious. I mean, my real concern was whether we could achieve that sense of intimacy that's, you know, that certainly I feel like you can achieve on the page. And so one thing we did, as Steve mentioned, is we kept the crew really small. The other thing I worried about, too, is – I mean, I had worked on a Frontline years ago. We used to – sometimes the crew would balloon up to five or six people. I mean, it was like you were having a party in somebody's apartment when you were filming. Also the thing, you know, having Steve behind the camera, I think, really made a difference, because Steve, I think, is really sensitive and sensible about sort of distance. And so you can see in the filming, you can see that sense of intimacy, how close we are to events, to individuals. And the other part were the interviews. You know, I'm accustomed, having, again, done stuff in TV, that, you know, you do all these pre-interviews. And so by the time you sit down with people, it's not fresh. People have been asked the questions already. The interviews go on for maybe half an hour and they're over. And what was really wonderful about this, I mean, it felt like I was working in print, is we would sit down for – we didn't do any pre-interviewing. We would sit down with Kobe, Amina, and Eddie, and Tio, and Gary Slutkin, and others, and sit down sometimes for hours on end. I mean, Kobe can tell you, we had some pretty exhausting marathon sessions. And they were extraordinary. Time wasn't an issue. We weren't concerned about tape. It was a matter of just really having a conversation.
But you also, I think, wisely, cut yourselves out of the film. There's not talking heads. It doesn't go back,
right,
back to you. And in fact, many people will probably see this film, and I imagine it's the way you would want it,
right,
and not even know there was an interview going on at all,
right,
because people are just speaking, and you guys are speaking,
right,
from your heart and,
right,
and cracking jokes and crying and being yourselves.
Right. Right. Yeah. I mean, you know, absolutely. I mean, one of the things Steve and I talked about very early on, I mean, there was some discussion about narrating this, but we felt, you know, the problem often with having a narrator is it's yet one more barrier to the people in the film. And we also felt that this was a film where we really kind of had our guides in Kobe, Amina, Eddie, Tio, who is this kind of surrogate narrator throughout the film. So it was really important. We were clear from the beginning that wanted to do this film without this omniscient voice.
Now, you showed the film initially at about 2.5 hours. Is that right?
Well,
2 hours 20?
Two forty. It
2:40.
Premiered at Sundance at 2:44.
Okay, so it's already been trimmed somewhat, 20 minutes or so.
That's yes, right. It has.
And does that feel like cutting off a part of your arm, or have you come to
accept the current
version?
We like it much better, actually.
Okay.
Yeah.
It was good to have some audience feedback.
Well, and not only that, it's like the film, we were extremely late submitting the film to Sundance. We really didn't even think it was going to be possible to have a film done for Sundance. And so we kind of missed all the deadlines. And so I ended up, because I've had films there before, I know people there, which is, you know, helpful. And so I called up this one programmer And I said, is it too late? And he was like, well, it's really late. And I said, well, he said, but I'll take a look at it. I said, okay, well, the cut we're going to send you is 3.5 hours long. It wasn't that long by the time it got to Sundance. But they, you know, and we just, he was like, 3.5 hours, you know, it was like, and, but I think that, you know, when they saw the potential of it and they knew that we were going to get it down. But I think by the time we got to Sundance, we literally finished it like the day before we left for Sundance. So what played at Sundance was the best we could do to still make the festival. And we've subsequently been able to trim it down.
As usual, pay no attention to what you read in newspapers about how movies are made and so on. This is what really happened, right?
That's right. Exactly.
I have to ask you, each and all, a kind of heavier question. Like you all say, and as people have been hearing from excerpts that we've been playing and so on, I mean, the movie is very inspiring as well as depressing. And the humor, the intelligence, the savvy, the wordplay that comes from all the people in the film is captivating all the time. But I couldn't help but think as I watched the film and afterwards, let's say, Kobe, that you all succeed with, you know, X percent of these people. Even a great teacher in a classroom knows that he or she reaches maybe 10%, 20% of the students. So you stop some of these things. You hope that some of these people don't get caught accidentally in somebody else's gunfire or whatever. Where's the interruption of our society? Why are people living in apartheid? Why do we still have a world where people are now even more forgotten than ever before? I mean, in a way, okay, so what? I mean, there's still no jobs. Education is such a mess. I mean, you can get caught up and say, wow, these are real humans living in this village, but why is there a fence around this village? I mean, isn't that the unhappy side of the inspirational story within the larger world?
Well, I was just going to say, you know, there's a scene in the movie where there's a town hall meeting, and it came about as a result of a state representative calling for the National Guard to come and patrol the streets of Chicago. And that created quite an uproar and, you know, a lot of press attention for the state representative. And so they had a town hall meeting where people were debating all this. And in both the town hall meeting and in the scene that we've created around it, we try to get into some of that essential question of, you know, you can focus on trying to stop individuals from committing violent acts, which is what Kobe and Amin and Eddie do day in and day out and succeed at doing, which is no small thing.
Not
at all. Or you can also look at what is the fertile ground in which that is all happening and that contributes to that and pushes that to happen. And there's a, you know, I think there's a really interesting debate to have there about the larger social forces at work in this society and when, if ever, those will change. But in the meantime, it's sort of like I'm so thankful that there are people like Kobe, Amin, and Eddie out there trying to save lives one by one, because if not for that, where would we be?
Alex?
Well, no, I think you raise, you know, it's sort of the underlying question throughout the film. I mean, you clearly can go in and make a difference in the lives of individuals, and you see that with Kobe, Eddie, and Amina. But you also see that it's not just about interrupting these moments of violence. You see the place of work, the place of family, the place of schools, the place of good housing in these people's lives. And it raises the very question that you ask is, what do we do about the conditions? What do we do about these communities that have been completely shunted aside? And I guess in some ways, I mean, part of our hope with this film is obviously to talk about what we can do to make a difference, but also to remind ourselves, I mean, as Steve alluded to earlier, how sobering it is to spend time in these communities that have been completely marginalized.
Kobe?
It's like, we get up every day to try to save somebody's life. We know we can't save everybody. We know all the mediations we do, some of them ain't going to be successful. But we put that effort in there and try to do it, though. And it's going to take a thousand Amina, Kobe's, and Eddie's, and you know, everybody to get involved somehow. Everybody can play a part in trying to save somebody. All right, we see young guys all day, every day who ain't got no father in the house. All right, it's a big guy down the street, a big brother, somebody. Try to mentor these kids and talk to them. A lot of times people find themselves talking about, oh, he bad, he bad. A lot of these kids don't be bad. You know what I'm saying? They just make bad choices in their life. And once you put that label on them, they bad, they bad. That's how they don't start living out like they bad. So we need – a lot of things need to be done. I think more recreation centers, more things need to be in the communities. Like if I'm staying in Englewood, why should I have to go to Auburn, Gresham, or Southwest or somewhere to go play basketball or to go swimming? We should be able to do that right in the neighborhood where I stay in. We shouldn't have to go other places. And a lot of people need to always stop, you know, a lot of times be saying, oh, I ain't going to worry about it. It ain't my kid. But it could affect your kid. Your kid, a lot of people getting shot and hurt, walking down the street, minding their business, end up just get caught in the crossfire. So it could be your kid. It could hit home.
There's a wonderful scene in the film where Amina is coming, a fight that's just taken place, and everyone's sort of gathered around her. And then she just pulls this little boy out from the crowd and has her hands on his shoulders and then on his head. And she says, whose baby is this? Whose shorty is this?
Yeah.
And the point is, this is everyone's baby. This is everyone's shorty. This is everyone's son. And so maybe to use the disease analogy and flip it around, if you can infect enough people with the idea to take a connection to the kids down the street, to the other things that are going on around them, maybe then you help to move people forward.
And it's important. I mean, and good thing we put our all into it, and we don't give up, and we ain't judgmental towards nobody. We all right saying he bad. See, we really deal with people who nobody don't want to deal with, who people say, oh, he bad, I don't want to have nothing to do with. Them the people we want to deal with, because me, Amina, and Eddie come from that background, though. You know, I mean, it took us time in our life to get where we at right now, but we had to go through some struggles to get there and all that, but a lot of times people throw their hands in on people, though. You know, don't give up. Like I say, I think my mama did what she could do for me. But my grandparents was just right there more and more. I mean, so don't give up on nobody. You know what I'm saying? Try to help them somehow. And once we try to help them and show them they can, it might just take that look, trying to help them and be consistent with it and trying. That helps straighten out the person. Man, at least they showing me that they care about me.
I do think that one of the hurdles, and it really goes to the heart of your initial question here. Amina can pull out that kid and say, you know, is he your responsibility, you guys in this circle? And I think what we hope the film can play a role in doing is really widening that circle. People seeing this movie who are not from Englewood, who are not even from these kinds of communities, who will look and say and feel some responsibility for that kid and for those folks. And I think what we're trying to do in this film through our interrupters and the lives they interrupt is really, on some level, is to just say there are living, breathing human beings in these communities that want all the same things you want living in the suburbs, and look at the hurdles that stand in their way. And I think if we can reach people that way, and with outreach and civic engagement that we hope will accompany this film, much like we do a lot with Kartemkin films, you know, we hope to widen that discussion and widen the impact.
In some ways, Kobe's, you know, personal testament to this. If we were to have run into Kobe 20 years ago, he's the kind of kid, right, we might have thrown our hands up to. Mm-hmm. We might have looked at him and said, you know, it's a lost cause. There's nothing we can do. And yet look at where he is today. And I think that, you know, each of the interrupters in the film are kind of a constant reminder of that. And so as you meet some of the youth, you can't help but think about where Kobe, Amina, and Eddie once were.
Well, as T.O. Hardiman says in the film, ain't just no anybody can tell someone to stop shooting, and ain't just no anybody can make a film about what's going on in our cities in the way that this film has been made by Steve James and Alex Kotlowitz, Kobe Williams and his colleagues Amina Matthews and Eddie Bocanegra in the film, who are makers of the film too, because you're showing what they're doing. So it's really been a pleasure and an honor to share this time with you. And obviously, we encourage everyone to see the film. It's going to be very interesting. I'm sure you've already had some experiences, but now that it's going to be coming home, to see the audiences downtown at the Film Center, the kind of art house film audience, and then to go to the west side and to the south side and to see what's going to happen when the film is shown in the communities. That's going to be worth a film or an epilogue or something in and of itself. Kobe Williams, Steve James, Alex Kotlowitz, thank you so much for coming in.
The Interrupters will be shown from August 12th to the 25th at the Gene Siskel Film Center on State Street in Chicago. Music we heard in this program, The World is a Ghetto by War. We'd like to thank our funders, Alpha Wood Foundation and Dick and Susan Kiphart, for their continued support. If you'd like to hear tonight's program again, you can do so anytime. It's part of the free Critical Thinking podcast that you can find at WFMT.com/criticalthinking. For Andrew Patner, I'm Matt DeStefano, hoping that you'll join us next week for the next edition of Critical Thinking.